Chris Wright is a Professor of Organisational Studies in the Business School at the University of Sydney. He is also the leader of a research network at the Business School called the Balanced Enterprise Research Network, BERN. BERN is a pillar of the newly formed Sydney Environment Institute. Today his talk, Creative Self-Destruction, Corporate Responses to Climate Change as Political Myths, forms part of the SEI Lunchtime Seminar Series.
Anyway, so what I'm going to talk about today is this paper which I've written with a former colleague here, Daniel Nyberg, who's now at the University of Nottingham. And the paper's entitled Creative Self-Destruction, Corporate Responses to Climate Change as Political Myths. So this is a paper based on research that Daniel and I have been doing now for probably about 5 years or so. And it explores how the project more generally explores how business organisations are responding to anthropogenic climate change. So this paper, as I was just saying to Tony earlier, is not specifically focused so much on the micro issues of organisations and corporations responding to climate change. It's more informed, I guess, by a broader sort of theoretical argument. And it's something of a tirade, so that's a bit of a warning. It's a bit of a sort of an academic rant. So for some of the practitioners in the room, you might find this all a bit comical or frustrating, I'm not sure. It's a paper born of our own frustration about essentially the mainstream obfuscation on climate change, both political, or largely political. Climate change is the catastrophe that dare not speak its name. So we talk a lot, and there's a political debate about climate change, but we don't actually talk about the real problems of climate change. It's a paper that was sort of driven out of the disconnect between ever-strengthening scientific evidence of the urgent catastrophic implications of increasing greenhouse gas emissions and the political response to this issue being noticeably weak, or some critics might argue completely absent. Now, some have argued, Anthony Giddens amongst them, that the major reason for this has to do with the temporal and spatial nature of climate change, that it's drawn out over generations, spatially global issues, so it's very hard to make it immediate and have an impact for individuals and in groups that is realistic. We argue in this paper the major reason for a lack of social and political engagement with climate change is the way in which a number of political myths reinforce the dominance of what we term a capitalist imaginary of endless economic growth. So our focus is very much on the economic system, promoting this vision that we can continue to grow on growing as we always have, ad infinitum, without any implications, without worrying about planetary boundaries and those sorts of things. In particular, we focus on three myths. We term corporate environmentalism, corporate citizenship, and corporate omnipotence. And we explore how those myths absorb and adapt the critique of our economic system, while still enabling ever more imaginative ways of exploiting nature. So we term this a process of creative self-destruction. A bit of a riff on Schumpeter, obviously. So rather than actually seeking to falsify these myths or sort of point to these myths being false, what the paper is really trying to do is explore how each of these myths is created and supported and re-narrated, and what those myths actually seek to achieve at a sort of a systemic level. The key argument is essentially that if we can highlight the nature of these political myths in relation to climate change, we need to do that as sort of a first step towards actually constructing alternative imaginaries or visions of what is possible in terms of responding to climate change. So to begin with, the first point I wanted to sort of start with, and there's a number of slides here, is this point that Bill McKibben's been making, that climate change is all around us, even though politically we choose not to see it. So evident in a procession of worsening storms, extreme weather events, floods, droughts, plus the mounting scientific data that has been accumulating over the last 40, 50 years, such that yesterday's worst case scientific scenario now becomes our best case future. So in the last few years, we've had the 2010 Russian heat wave and drought, resulting in the death of 56,000 people, apparently. The Pakistan floods in 2010, resulting in displacement of 20 million people. The death spiral, so-called, of the Arctic ice sheet, with 2012 setting new records. I've gone ahead of myself. The 2011-2012 drought, US drought, the worst in US history in the Southwest, in Texas and Arizona, what have you. The declining Arctic ice sheet, which has set new records, ice-free summer of Arctic likely within a decade or two. And then, of course, Superstorm Sandy in New York City. So the symbolic flooding of, well, not symbolic, the real flooding of the symbolic centre of global capitalism, and the shutdown of the city. In Australia, we've also, of course, had our own extreme weather events, so our angry summer of 2012-2013, 123 weather records broken in 90 days. That's a graphic, of course, from the Climate Commission, which has recently been disbanded and turned into the Climate Council through crowdsourcing. In January this year, the Bureau of Meteorology had to invent new colours on the weather map to record summer temperatures, 54 degrees Celsius in the centre there in the purple. And we've had images such as this famous one from the Tasmanian bushfires in January with the family sheltering from the firestorm in the estuary below their home. And then, of course, last week, or the week before, we had the unprecedented October City bushfires. So we've had this ongoing procession of extreme weather events. There's a debate about whether they can link any particular extreme weather event to climate change, yada, yada, yada. But in addition to that, and there is science which can make those links, we also have the data from climate scientists, which keeps piling on top of each other, that there is something seriously wrong in terms of our projections, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, ocean acidification and what have you. So that has led well-known radical activist organisations like PricewaterhouseCoopers, the International Energy Agency and even the World Bank, syndicalists, to proclaim we're on track for a 4-degree warmer world marked by extreme heat waves, declining global food stocks, loss of ecosystems and biodiversity and life-threatening sea level rise. So no big problem. And yet, just watch the cord. Despite that dire prognosis, tangible political action remains extremely limited. Largely rhetorical flourishes about sustainability and emissions targets against a backdrop of even greater fossil fuel exploitation. The Galilee Basin, the tar sands in Canada, the Arctic oil rig drilling. What's happening to our global greenhouse gas emissions? Well, this year we got to 400 parts per million, according to the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. Atmospheric concentration of CO2 exceeding 400 parts per million, a figure not seen on Earth for 2 to 3 million years and well before humans had evolved on the planet. So that's the sort of the disconnect I get looking at this issue from a perspective of organisation studies and social theory, that there is something happening quite fundamental, an existential threat to our own future existence, and yet the political debate maintains this sort of fiction. It won't confront the sort of the elephant in the room. So this is what sort of drove this paper. Why are we not responding? And I know a lot of people have written about this. I mentioned Giddens earlier around the sort of the nature of climate change, particularly as a wicked problem, that sort of thing. But our take on this, I guess, is, well, I'll come to that in a moment. This sort of graphic, I guess, gets to this. So this is a quote from a book which sort of gets this theme of a Faustian bargain that we've sort of made. We've done it to ourselves, we've only begun to pay. For many commentators, it's a Faustian bargain. Modernity's deal with the devil, the inevitable consequence of our material excess, our crimes against nature, our willful innocence, our invincible arrogance. And there strikes me a strong sort of theme of hubris and arrogance in the way we sort of approach this issue. On the one hand, surely we can't be affecting the environment, we're too small, and yet this sort of idea that humanity is omnipotent, we can do what we like, we can geoengineer the planet if we want to. So in the actual paper proper, which I won't go into now, we engage with a sort of a Marxist critique of capital accumulation and the links to capitalism's history and ecological degradation. So there's sort of an argument around the sort of argument. Well, there's an argument around the idea that our economic system is based upon the inherent sort of degradation of nature over time. So the argument here is Faust made a deal with the devil for his magic powers, so humanity has relied on the destruction of nature for its economic development. That's accentuated under global capitalism, and our day of ecological reckoning has now come. Now, we don't want to acknowledge this decline because we're still enjoying our magical powers. We still enjoy living like gods and being able to fly around the planet, enjoy the latest iPhone, these sorts of things. What we're sort of focusing in on here is how political myths underpin this denial, this sort of collective denial. And more than that, not just denial, they drive us to even greater fealty or support or promotion of the economic system. So we sort of term this process creative self-destruction, because not only are we just in denial, but we are sort of encouraged to invent even more inventive ways to increase our carbon emissions, increase our consumption. So the idea of myth. So myth, of course, has a long history in the social sciences, a long intellectual pedigree. This isn't actually in the paper, but I just sort of threw this in, the link to anthropology studies of the role of myth in primitive communities. So this is Malinowski's studies of villages in the east coast of New Guinea in the early 20th century. He explored the role of myth and magic, and this distinction between activities in these societies which were uncertain and more certain and predictable, and the role that myth and magic played in these. So he made the distinction between those communities who were fishing in lagoons with a fair degree of certainty and predictability, and there was not as much reference to magic, but when they went out in the deep blue sea, much greater unpredictability, much greater dangers and difficulties, the role of magic and ritual became much more important. In fact, magic and ritual offered warrants, confidence, certainty. It gave meaning to master the unknown and significance in a world indifferent to our survival. So there's that aspect of the purpose that myths play, but also myths are political. They justify hierarchies and they justify power. So in primitive societies, the hierarchy of clans and that's those sorts of things. If we consider a modern society, we like to think we're a rational society, we don't believe in myths and magic. And yet we can still argue that myths are critical in playing particular functions in terms of justifying social structure and rationalising political agendas. They're expressions of how we should act. So in the paper, we engage with this concept of political myth, which comes from the social critic Chiara Battici. And she's used this concept of political myth to explore big debates in society around political conflicts. So, for instance, she explores Samuel Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations and argues that here Huntington's thesis can be understood as a political myth, a process, one of continuous work narrating the responses that are needed by society and by political parties. She argues human beings need meaning in order to master the world they live in, but they also need significance in order to live in a world that is indifferent to them. So this is the purpose, she argues, myths perform. Political myths are narratives through which we orient ourselves and act and feel about our political world. So when we follow Battici, we use her definition in the paper. A political myth is a common narrative that addresses political conditions or criticism facing society, particularly as a response to criticism. We think this concept's quite powerful. And I keep stressing here, we're not attempting to prove that these myths are false, per se. What we're really interested in this paper in exploring how business and corporations and politicians sort of explain climate change. We're interested in the purposes of these particular myths, the purposes they perform, the significance they give to certain actors in this process. So we're not looking at them as fictitious accounts necessarily, but we're exploring the process of how they're constructed and what purpose they're trying to achieve. Okay, so in the paper, and I should state, the paper started as largely a sort of conceptual piece, and it's been submitted to a journal, and it's being revised for resubmission, and one of the key responses, well, this argument's nice, but where's your evidence? So we've had to sort of, we're turning what was largely a conceptual paper into a more empirical paper, and we're drawing on this broad study that we've done looking at different businesses from different industries, how they interpret, make sense of climate change, how they respond in terms of practices and strategies. For this paper, we're really interested in what that broader data tells us about these processes of myth-making. So data from 25 corporations in resources, energy, manufacturing, transportation, finance, retail. You can see the industry breakdown there. Okay, the three myths we focus in on. The first myth we've termed corporate environmentalism. And of course, corporate environmentalism is a well-known term in the literature. There are books written on this. We're exploring it from this perspective of political myth. But essentially, corporate environmentalism promotes the idea that economic growth and ecological well-being are mutually inclusive. There's a win-win here. We can actually have economic growth of the right kind and still have a sustainable environment. We can do well by doing good, a sort of business sustainability argument. So the basic narrative, the concept dates back really to the 1960s in the response to Rachel Carson's and Silent Spring, the response to criticism of industries like the chemical industry and the auto industry in the US, and increasing government regulation as a result of that criticism. So you had laws passed around chemical emissions and emissions from the auto industry, public concern about pesticides, and well-known incidents like oil spills. The government comes in and regulates in response to these catastrophes and crises. The response to that from industry was the emergence, as Andy Hoffman has documented in his book on the history of corporate environmentalism, essentially an institutionalisation of this within business, the establishment of environmental concerns, environmental specialists within corporate organisations. And it's evolved over time through the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s. And in a sense, corporate environmentalism has been rejuvenated again in the year of the 2000s with the concern of climate change, particularly for industries which are high greenhouse gas emitting industries. So this has shifted from simple regulatory compliance to a sort of a conception that business can strategically intervene and make money, make profit, but make the world a better place at the same time. So this image from GE, this is the famous Eco-Imagination sort of program. It says there down the bottom. The sort of idea of creating value, but also doing it in a way in which the environment is maintained or improved. It portrays corporations in a particular light. So it portrays corporations potentially as saviours of the environment. I don't think that's stretching it too far, as this ad sort of suggests. It emphasises particular objects, green products and services that corporations can produce, the wind turbines, the hybrid car. It stresses particular practices in business organisations that should be pursued, so reducing waste, improving energy efficiency, reducing cost, improving productivity. I'm not saying these things are bad necessarily, but they're part of this process. And those are achieved through innovation, new technologies. The idea is we can have our cake and eat it too. We can have production and consumption, first world living standards, and still have a habitable environment. So the focus is on win-win outcomes, as opposed to the more traditional sort of trade-off between profits and environmental well-being. So I've alerted Tony to this image. So this is from News Limited, their 1 degree culture change program and eco-efficiency program. So the message here, around the idea of employees and possibly also consumers, through changing their behaviour, can have a positive impact on the environment. In a similar vein, this is from one of the banks, we will play a pivotal role helping our customers, employees, broader community shift to this low carbon economy. The other aspect, I guess, of corporate environmentalism, if we view it from this perspective of myth, is the roles that it emphasises and the actions that come from that. So it provides significance to our experiences as employees and customers and the actions that we take. So, for instance, the Nissan Leaf ad, this is the sort of the consumption argument. You can buy the Nissan Leaf and the polar bear will hug you. So you can save the polar ice caps by buying the Nissan Leaf. And not surprisingly, you get criticism of this in terms of greenwashing, as Guy Pearce has documented, and there will be a counter-narrative that will come back to that. Yes, there are problems with that possibly, but it's still possible to engineer a mass consumption automobile which will still solve the problems of global warming, possibly. So we get this sort of criticism and response, this dialectic happening all the time around corporate environmentalism. Significance of the myth, I think, is that it promotes the possibilities of action, but it also defends the status quo at a macro level in terms of consumption. So this point here from marketing manager at big manufacturer, it's all about recognising this change is happening, like climate change, and taking a leadership position to be able to leverage from the opportunities that come out of it. So there is an upside opportunity for business here in terms of value creation. But possibly we can reduce some of our impact. The sort of line I quite like is Andy Hoffman's point about the problem with the discussion of sustainability in business settings is that it's not really sustainability. It's about being a little less unsustainable, which is not sustainability, which I think is quite a critical point. There is a lot of sort of obfuscation around this concept of it being sustainable, that either businesses or the economy of the world really hadn't got their head around yet. Okay, the other aspect around corporate environmentalism, of course, is green consumption. So to consumers, the argument is you can salve your guilt by consuming the right type of products. The green, low-carbon beer, the hybrid Prius car, or whatever it might be. Carbon offsetting, offsets for your flights. Green energy. So consumer choice here is portrayed as a sort of a democratic ideal. And so it's another important sort of outcome of this myth around the role of the consumer. We suggest the consequences of this myth are quite profound. It presents corporations as best placed to respond to climate change. So politically, this is quite important for governments and political parties who find this difficult. They can quite easily step back and say, well, don't have to worry. Corporations will handle it. Multinationals will save the world. The human response to climate change can then be converted into a reinforcement of business as usual. Business is almost usual. Some tweaking, some improved efficiency, but basically we can just keep doing what we're doing and we'll get to where we need to go. By being, green, consumers, employees, what have you. The second myth I want to engage with is this idea of corporate citizenship. And you'll probably recognise these fellows. And the point here is essentially around how the political sphere has embraced the role of business in this process. So Cameron and Romney. The basic narrative here is the corporation is a moral citizen engaged in the betterment of civil society. It's no longer just the share value maximising a moral actor. It has a sort of broader political moral purpose. It's interested not just in its shareholders, but a broader range of stakeholders, including society and the community. And this has a long historical pedigree going right back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, really, responses to criticism of industry and capital. The response being, business will do the right thing. It's become a very common form of discourse. We see it in annual reports and websites. The United Nations Global Compact has sort of institutionalised the concept of the good corporate citizen. And the narrative is reinforced nationally, as I'm suggesting here. Quote from Cameron's quite telling, business is the most powerful force for social progress the world has ever known. So what does the myth do? What does the myth of corporate citizenship do? It provides legitimacy for increasing the scope of not just corporate industrial activity, but corporate political activity. And we see what we see now in the US in terms of corporate funding of political campaigns, corporate funding of sort of faux social movements like the Tea Party, these sorts of phenomena, which can extend to corporations having a voice in political campaigning to protect their rights, but also create space for normal citizens to have a role to play in corporate campaigns. This campaign by Chevron, I think, is quite telling. So Chevron, big global oil company, and their public proposition is, we'll never stop looking for alternatives. We're an oil company. But right now, we're also providing natural gas, solar, hydrogen, geothermal, and then the crunch, because we live on this planet too. This is who we are. So it's this personification of the corporation as a concerned citizen trying to solve this planetary problem. So it personifies the corporation and gives the corporation legitimacy in the political space around issues that matter to it, like, for instance, greenhouse gas emissions and potential regulation there. Corporations have valid claims to social and political rights now in this sort of this presentation, this sort of mythology. And it also serves quite critically to shape legislative outcomes. The corporation becomes a key player in through political activity and lobbying and shaping what these outcomes might be. It also, though, produces political identities and meaning for normal citizens. So this image here from the last presidential campaign in the US, the coal miners for Romney, for instance. And through astroturfing, obviously, the Tea Party sort of analogy. So this mythology creates space for citizenship activities, much like in corporate environmentalism, the role of the citizen is to consume green products. Here, the role of the citizen is to partake in political campaigns and vote for possibly corporate types of agendas. So this is the Australian analogy, the public campaign against the carbon tax. If you sort of analyse some of the coal industry advertisements around that, it was quite clever in framing the voice of the normal citizen as the response to the legislation. So factory workers, miners, small business owners, consumers, opposing the government's pricing of carbon emissions as a threat to their jobs, to the business, to the economy. Indeed, in many of the rallies, the carbon tax, these citizens actually re-emphasise those discourses of regulation, threatening jobs, increasing cost of living, the sort of images we saw on the television set. So the myth actually not just creates a role and significance for corporations, but also for ordinary citizens. It gives them a social identity, potentially, a voice. What's good for the corporation is good for all citizens. So in some ways, we haven't come far from post-war, what was good for GM is good for America. The third myth we've termed corporate omnipotence, and this is probably the biggest and hardest to pin down in a way, but it gets to this sort of issue that systemically our response to climate change should be framed very much within the prevailing economic system. There is no alternative. Capitalism and corporate capitalism in particular is portrayed as the inevitable and superior form of economic organisation. So a riff back to the sort of the end of the Cold War. And through the use of rational, effective managerial tools and practices, we'll crack this, we'll solve climate change. So the myth of corporate omnipotence, I think, is interesting because it explains the success of capitalism as an economic system, where we've got to now, a fantastic standard of living, the technological magic that we all enjoy. But it's also an answer to its failure. So the answer to the failure of the externalities of climate change is more capitalism, more market mechanisms, more market logic. So the pattern here is essentially to respond to climate change through the rubric of the market system. So commodify nature upon a market logic. So the problem, climate change, is soluble through corporate expertise. We just need to get the right economic levers applied and we will solve the problem. So the logical analogy or example here would be the Stern Report and the Garneau Report and pretty well everything else that's come past that. In terms of seeing anthropogenic climate change as an economic problem, it's a problem of not pricing externalities. And if we price the externalities, we will solve the problem. This creates a commodity of carbon emissions and tradable carbons. Now, again, you know, I'm a strong advocate of pricing carbon, not critiquing it necessarily for that point. But the broader issue, I think, is what this is doing to our perception of the problem and what it means for the environment more generally. It can be, as Michael Sandel suggested, we just turn everything into a market opportunity, a market society. A market economy becomes a market society. So even amongst those businesses which are very progressive in seeking a response to climate change, and many of the companies I've listed are at the cutting edge of being, of dealing with this issue, recognising it and trying to do something about it, it inevitably becomes framed within market economics, risk and opportunity. So as one of the financial institutions we talked to explained how they make sense of climate change, it's all about risk and opportunity. And the opportunity is finding new markets and new products that can be brought to bear around climate change. So this bank here is talking about carbon trading as one of our responses, educating and building capacity amongst our clients and internally, integrating carbon risk into our credit systems, customer solutions, renewable energy investment, pricing risk management tools in terms of carbon trading. So there's a whole plethora of activities and products and markets which are occurring within financial institutions based around this particular framing of climate change. The myth of corporate omnipotence therefore directs particular policy outcomes. It focuses very much on regulatory responses which are aimed at privatisation and marketisation. It's not in favour of the idea of government coming in and mandating change and regulating change in a fairly draconian fashion. So the market response will save us in this case, and it's the best way to engage with this issue. What does that mean for identities, favoured sort of political identities in this myth? Well, there's a focus on being enterprising. This is a market opportunity. We need to be enterprising. We need to create space for enterprising individuals or ecopreneurs to solve this problem. So this image here, anybody remember this? This is Northwest America. That brown smudge there. You may not remember it, but in 2012, an American businessman dumped 120 tonnes of iron dust into the North Pacific Ocean to create an algal bloom for storing carbon. So he basically did an arrangement with the native peoples there and said, I can solve your problems with salmon fishing, just need to rejuvenate the ocean, I'll create an algal bloom by dumping all these iron filings in the ocean. It's the first sort of self-initiated geoengineering experiment in a way, if we ignore the broader geoengineering experiment of what we're doing to the atmosphere. Now, it was celebrated by some, roundly criticised by most scientists as sort of a renegade action. But that's sort of where we're heading in a way. If we move back from the idea of government and regulation and multilateral sort of agreements, we're creating space for enterprising opportunities. And how soon before we'll have other geoengineering rogue interventions occurring, possibly because there's a sort of a monetary advantage in undertaking them. So solar radiation management, ocean fertilisation, et cetera, et cetera. And Clive Hamilton's written a book recently on this whole geoengineering phenomenon. So, aware of the time, I've been going on a bit. Just to wrap up, what we're suggesting here is that there are three corporate myths that sort of, or political myths, that are critical in terms of the role of business engaging with this issue of climate change. And each myth, we've sort of stressed a basic sort of narrative. What the sort of the objects and practices are linked to there, the identities that those myths promote, and their broader significance. The final slide I'll come to, and I love this image, this was in the Mossman Daily about 6-8 months ago. It's Balmoral Beach. I grew up here, so that's why it sort of resonates, I guess. But the local paper had a story on the local council was rejecting, changing its planning laws around sea level rise, what the CSIRO and the Weather Bureau and all these people, what would they know about sea level? We all know climate change isn't happening. And besides, it'll hurt property prices in Mossman, so we can't have that. So they had this front page story, and then rather mischievously, the journalist or the photographer had gone down to Balmoral Beach and got the actor to dig a hole and put his head in the sand to take a photo. So the image was sort of the complete antithesis of the story. But I guess just to wrap up here, what we're trying to do in the paper is to sort of generate potentially a more fundamental conversation about human responses to this most fundamental threat to our existence. Paul Gilding's made the point in his book, The Great Disruption, that in previous periods of extreme peril, some societies have been able to quickly fashion new political myths that galvanise fairly rapid changes in terms of organisations and governments and society. So he talks a lot about World War II and what happened in Britain and the threat of sort of Nazi invasion. Climate change clearly presents a threat of much greater and unparalleled complexity and extent to humanity. And I think there is the potential here for alternative social imaginaries of human organisation. But to get to that stage, we, I think, need to be aware of, or at least talk about, some of the meanings that underpin our current sort of economic and political response to this issue. So I'll leave that there, but be interested in your comments, and I will try and respond to them. Thanks.